All right. So, good morning. Thanks very much for being here today. Can you hear me okay? Okay. Thanks, Ron. Thanks, Mr. Soundman, wherever you are. I just want to thank everybody for letting me sneak in today. I kind of snuck in ahead of time because I thought it would be fun to talk to people and see how things are going. And I'm just really delighted to see so many folks here today. So thank you very much for taking time out of your day. I know you could have slept in, but thanks for coming in and sleeping here while we're doing meditation. Just kidding. Thanks very much for being here. Today, before I start my talk, I'm going to imitate something that Lama Tom did last week, which I thought was kind of cool. He started with the recitation of a Buddhist prayer. And it's a kind of a typical Tibetan thing to start with a prayer. And the prayer we're going to do is on page 4. If you're already familiar with this prayer, the 4-line prayer of taking refuge in the Buddha as the teacher, the Dharma as the path, and the Sangha as your community. If you're already familiar with this prayer, that's great. But if you're unfamiliar with it and chanting's not your thing, you can just kind of join in your heart, and join in your mind, and think that you dedicate this session of teaching and discussion, that you dedicate it to the benefit of all sentient beings. So I'll recite this prayer 3 times. O Sanje Chudan Soji Cho Namla Jang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Suchi Da Ji Jin So Ji Be Sunam Ki Dro La Pen Chi Sanje Dru Par Sho Sanje Chu Dan So Ji Cho Nam La Chang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Su Chi Da Ji Jin So Ji Be Su Nam Ki Dro La Pen Chi San Je Dru Par Sho San Je Chu Da So Ji Cho Nam La Chang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Su Chi Da Ji Jin So Ji Be Su Nam Ki Dro La Pen Shi San Je Dru Par Sho. Hey, thank you. I'll recite one short prayer of my own and then we'll begin. O Palden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chi War Pe De Ten Shula Kadren Chenpo Go Ne Che Song Te Ho Song Tugi Ngo Trup Sao Tu Song. Thank you. Happy to be here and I'm happy to see everyone here. I know some of you from Facebook. But it's really nice to acquaint ourselves with one another in what you might call old school social networking, which is face-to-face conversation. It's real old school, but I hear it's coming. I hear it's making a comeback. I hear it's making a comeback. People are meeting each other in very interesting places these days, airports and streets around the country, and so there are a lot of people getting together. So I think old school social networking may be coming back into style. But anyway, let me say again, thank you for being here. Today, I'm going to finally get around to the third of my 3-part talk about making change in one's life. If you remember, we started on the first day of the new year on January 1st, it was the first lecture in this series. And we spoke about the custom of New Year's resolutions and how we do our best, but sometimes our resolutions don't quite work out. And so we talked a little bit about what the whole business of making resolutions is all about. And I made a few suggestions of a few that you could think about and consider for your year, such as being kinder to yourself, being kinder to others, and so forth. I guess I'm a little bit prejudiced because I'm a Buddhist. I have kind of a Buddhist way of looking at things. And so because of that, the resolutions that I selected as suggestions for everyone were those resolutions that reflected the Buddhist principles of self-compassion and compassion for others. So that was the first talk. That was a short summary of the first talk. The second talk was maybe 1 or 2 weeks later, talking about how to resist the itch to do things that cause harm to ourselves and cause harm to others. Sometimes it might feel so potentially good in thinking, like, well, I'm really going to tell that person off, or I'm really going to give that person a piece of my mind. There's a little bit of an itch to, shall we say, exert our self-fixation. We have this itch. And how do we hold ourselves back from that? And that was the topic of the second talk. To hear all of the different techniques that were shared for how to hold ourselves back. You can listen to the talk. But the short answer is, first, by recognizing that some of our old patterns may not really be so useful after all. They might give us a moment of relief or saying, well, I really told that person off, or I really did that, or I really did that. There might be this, like, a hair tip of satisfaction, but then we usually fall down into a pit of one kind or another. And then that, we talked about the disadvantages of that. So that was the second talk in the series. Today, I'd like to talk about something that's near and dear to my heart, which is, why is it so hard to do the right thing? Because if we really think about the process of resolving to make changes in our life, many of the changes we want to make in our life are helpful to us, and as well, they're helpful to others. So you could say that we're trying to change our lives for the better when we resolve to be more loving, more compassionate, and so forth. But the itch to do something that's not like that is still there, to sort of exert our negativity is still there. And we also sometimes feel a little, shall we say, restrained, or we have a hard time motivating ourselves to do the things that are the most helpful to us. I have people tell me all the time, why is it that I have a difficult time exercising? Because I know it's good for me. How come I have such a hard time doing what's right for me? Or how come I have so much difficulty actually sitting and doing my meditation? How is it that I have such a hard time adding meditation to my daily schedule? How is it that I have so much trouble with these things? And so today I thought I would talk a little bit about why it's so hard to do what's good for us. So I figure that these three talks will hopefully help and inform each other. And thanks to my friends in the technology field, these are currently, the first two are up online right now, right, Ian? Okay, so webmaster, thank you, Ian. They're up online, so through your help and the other team members, the first two are online right now, and you can listen to them online. Next best thing to a podcast is that. So then today, I thought we would start with this idea of the idea of making change. And I think the first thing that is needed is the decision. We have to make the decision of what we want to change. Kempo Carter Rinpoche, the 92-year-old founder of our center, in his book, Dharma Paths, he said, sometimes you have to make a list of the things that you want to change. And he put it a little differently. He said, there's always something that stands in the way for us. We might call them our faults. Our tendencies to do the wrong things. And so he said, maybe the thing to start with is start by making a list of what you want to work on, and then keeping that list in a place where you can look at it from time to time. And he said the purpose of this is twofold. Number one, you'll know what you're working on and you won't get lost because you forgot somehow. But the other reason is that you will know how not to be offended when other people point these things out to you. For example, if you see something you want to change is you want to be more patient, if you write it down, it will help you when people say to you, how come you're so impatient? Because you know, if you don't make a note of these things, other people will help you and make a note of them for you. Or if you lack generosity, somebody will say to you, how come you're so stingy all the time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So having a goal or a list is a good place to start. So that's the first thing we need to have. Second thing we need to have is this idea of protecting our goodness by resisting those negative urges. And then the third thing to do is to strengthen our motivation to do what's right for us and what's right for others. Sometimes they are the same thing. Sometimes they're not, but sometimes they are exactly the same thing. Often we don't do the right thing because we don't know the value of that right thing. I have a lot of friends in 12-step recovery, and they say that what guides them is they just go and do the next right thing. They go and do the next right thing. But it does take a little while to figure out what that right thing is. It takes a little while, and there's a little trial and error involved in knowing what the right thing is to do. But if we keep at it and don't give up, then we'll be more likely to make those changes than we would if we don't keep the goal in front of us. As one of my friends on Twitter said today, eyes on the prize. You know, you have to keep your eye on where you're going. And I think one of the ways to become familiar with the right thing is to become familiar with one of the key teachings of Buddhism, which is the preciousness of our opportunity, of the preciousness of our current life, the preciousness of our life, or our wonderful, precious life. And I think what's interesting about this is that we may forget sometimes that we have a precious life. We may be very busy focusing on things that are wrong with our life. I don't have this. I don't have that. I wish I had this. I wish I had that. We may focus on the things that we don't have rather than looking at the things we already have. We already have the ability to see what is right, even if we don't always choose it. We have the ability to see it. We have a mind that can discern and figure out and analyze things. This is a very precious thing. Yes, I know, sometimes my mind makes me do crazy things too. But on the other hand, the Buddha taught that we all have something called Buddha nature. We all have basic goodness. That's what some teachers choose to call Buddha nature, basic goodness. It's the part of us that guides us to what is right. It's the part of us that feels good when we are generous and feels not so good when we are stingy. It's the part of us that feels good when we are kind to others and not so good when we harm them. There's this basic goodness that's inside us. And if we think about this basic goodness and make the aspiration and reflect on it and make the aspiration, may I expand my connection to this basic goodness. This is how you begin to choose to do the right thing, by looking at what the right thing is. So there's a reflection that is taught in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. It's called the reflection on the preciousness of our life. And you reflect on this in your meditation seat. You really only need to take maybe 2 minutes, 3 minutes when you're meditating, but you reflect on this. You think, well, I've been through a lot in my life. I've been through a lot. Some of it's not been very good, but I'm still here. I'm still here. I still have my feet on the ground. I'm still alive. And where there is life, there is a future. There is hope. And so we start by thinking about what we've been through and thinking, I survived that. I've been through that. I've come out the other side, and I'm still coming out the other side. We think about, no matter what, I'm still here. You think, I could have been in lots of worse places, but here I am. I'm in a good place now. I'm in a good place now. I've got my wits, most of them, and I've got my wits, and I've got my ability to connect, and I've got, I guess what you could say is a full packet of tools to do good. I have a body, which is mostly healthy. I have a speech, which is mostly good, and I have a mind, which is mostly good. I have the tools to do good. Reminding ourselves of that can sometimes be very helpful. And then if we reflect on that, we might come to the realization, you know, where I am right now, it's a precious opportunity, and it could go either way. So I choose for it to go in a positive way. So that's how this reflection begins. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end to this reflection. You don't just go turn something over in your mind. There's a beginning to it, a middle to it, and an end to it. The beginning is, I could have been anywhere, but I am here. I could have been born in all kinds of really, really much more unfortunate situations than the ones I found myself in the past. And I got through the things I've been through, and now I'm on the other side of those things, or I'm getting through them now. I'm working through them right now. I'm in a better place now than I was 3 weeks ago, or I'm in a better place now than I was 3 years ago. I was in this idea of looking back and seeing where you are now as a way of encouraging ourselves toward the future. We can reflect on that. And there might be a moment in the middle of that reflection where we feel, I guess you could call it a moment of recognition. There's a moment of recognition, like, wow, I really am in a better place now than I was in before. I really am in a better place. Wow. And that moment of recognition may only last a couple of seconds. But that moment of recognition then can lead you to the third part of this reflection, which is to make the resolution, I'm going to take this and keep going. I'm going to continue to practice mindfulness. I'm going to continue to practice meditation. I'm going to continue to practice goodness and what is right. I'm going to continue to be kind to myself, and I'm going to continue to be kind to others. And so if we can reflect on this every day, I know 2 minutes out of every day, it's a little tough. I know I have to check Twitter. But 2 minutes, maybe right after Twitter, or maybe right before. Anyway, a few minutes out of every day, if you reflect like that, it will give you some strength. It'll give you the strength of a resolution. It'll give you the strength of going on. And we can also, if you have time, reflect on impermanence. Impermanence helps a lot, because I've got this precious opportunity, but it may not last forever. It could change tomorrow. It could change today. It could change in 5 minutes. So what we have to do is say, because I have a good situation right now, and because it could change in a moment, I really got to get busy. And then you make the aspiration, may I have kindness and love for myself. May I have kindness and love for others. There's a prayer in the book. I think the prayer of the Four Immeasurables. Arvind, I hate to ask you again, but could you tell me what page the Four Immeasurables are? Page 5? Okay. Page 5 in English, yeah, you might see it's like, may all beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May they have that great happiness which is freedom from suffering. I'm just making this up. May they dwell in that great equanimity free of attachment and aversion. Some version of that is in that book. I think that this is something, you can take a picture of it with your cell phone, take it home, and think about this every day. When you don't know what to do, when you're not sure what the right thing is, you just think that prayer. Don't worry about the Tibetan, that's fancy, but what you really need is the English. The idea is, May I and all beings be happy, and may we have the causes of happiness, because the Buddha taught that the cause of happiness is beneficial action, virtuous action, benefiting and taking care of oneself and benefiting and taking care of others. And then may we be free from suffering and its causes. The cause of suffering then is harming oneself and harming others. So we want people to both have happiness and its causes, and we want them to be free from suffering and its causes. And so if we reflect on that, this will give us an on-the-spot clue about whether the next thing we're going to do is going to be the right thing or not. We have a clue. We have a go-by. If it will bring about goodness for ourselves and others, it's probably okay. If it will bring about suffering for ourselves and others, probably not so good. And so, but this aspiration is a good aspiration to make every day. So this is something you can take home and use. Like I say, we all got cell phones, and you know, we can all make a copy of that in some way or other. And so that's something that we can do to encourage ourselves and reflect on the benefit that we can do. And if you think about it, if we do what is right and avoid what is wrong, meaning if we benefit others and restrain ourselves from harming them, it's basically saving ourselves from slavery. It's saving ourselves from bondage to our mental afflictions. When we are in bondage to our mental afflictions, it's like having a gigantic dog on a leash, and the dog is taking you for a walk. Right? Not all gigantic dogs are bad, but the ones that are untamed can lead you into traffic. I'm just saying. And so one of the things we can do is reflect and recite prayers like the Four Immeasurables that help us remember what's important. But one of the things that we can also do is we can take good care of ourselves. We can start by doing good and taking care of ourselves. And self-compassion is something we often forget, but it's extremely valuable, so I'm going to speak about that for a few minutes, and we're going to do a little exercise. What's interesting is that I'm learning a lot about modern ways of teaching Buddhism from Kempo Karma Tenkyong at Karma Triana Dharma Chakra, our home monastery, KTD in Woodstock, New York. At our home monastery, there's a young teacher there named Kempo Karma Tenkyong. And he uses PowerPoint. And he gives lectures with PowerPoint, and he has people do yoga. He's really kind of amazing. I'm sort of a stand-and-deliver kind of boring old-school lecturer. But like he has all these fancy ways to help people understand Dharma. But he also has them do little exercises. So I had him come and give a lecture for my pastoral care training group. And we're just getting ready to go into the fourth semester of a four-semester program on how to take care of oneself and how to take care of others through pastoral care in the Buddhist tradition. So he said, I want to start by encouraging you to take good care of yourselves and to have compassion for yourselves. He says, I know, a lot of people say, but I don't have compassion for myself. And in fact, I don't like myself very much. And he said, I see this a lot. He said, so can we do a little exercise? So we all get to do this little exercise. He had us do it, and it was kind of surprising. You don't know where it's going till the end, so it's kind of fun. It's going to be just two short things. The first thing he told us to do was to take in a deep breath and hold it for as long as you can. So that's the first one. So we'll start by doing that. So you breathe in, and then you hold that. Whew. breathe out. Okay, that was a little tough, wasn't it? Yeah, for some people it's harder than others. Then the other thing he had us do, he said, now breathe out and wait as long as you can before you breathe in again. So now we're going to do that. Okay, breathe in again. Okay, not so easy, right? And what he said was, he said, this exercise is useful because it shows us that we actually care for ourselves. Hi. We actually care for ourselves very much. He said it's proof that no matter what we may say in our heads, I don't like myself, or I don't care for myself, or whatever, he said, you actually do sort of like yourself. Because otherwise, you wouldn't have bothered to breathe in again. Which I thought was pretty interesting. He said, part of you, no matter what your intellectual head analysis is telling you, oh, I'm bad, I'm bad, I'm bad. Part of you knows you're fine, and part of you wants you to keep going. And he said, that's the basic goodness. That's your basic goodness. Your basic goodness is having you take care of yourself, no matter what your chatter-chatter habitual mind is telling you. You really care for yourself. And he said, and so what you do is you take that basic knowledge and expand it. You take that basic knowledge and expand it. And in the Tibetan tradition, we take that basic knowledge and expand it by doing the practice of meditation. We meditate. We allow our breath to come in and go out without holding it. We let our breath come and go, and we place our attention on the breath as it comes and goes. And when our attention wanders from that, we bring it back. When our attention wanders from the breath, we bring it back to the breath over and over and over again. And what this does is it slowly gives us the power to change our attention, to change our mind, to change what we invest our attention in. And we can slowly change anything. Because if you can drop one thought in meditation, if you can drop even a single thought and return your attention to the breath, that was a powerful thing you just did. For that moment, you changed what was on your mind. You took the power back and used it to benefit yourself and others. You did it. You changed it. It happened. So when people come to me and they say, oh, I get distracted a lot in meditation, I always say to them, well, do you come back? And they said, well, sure, but isn't the point not to be distracted? And I said, well, if you notice and come back, you're doing a great job because you're slowly getting less distracted and less distracted and less distracted. You're developing slowly undistractedness. So you have to be distracted to practice undistractedness, if that helps. So, at any rate, it's just something to keep in mind. This is something that we do in meditation practice, but the other thing we can train ourselves in is compassion. And so, before I conclude what I'm going to talk about today, I want to share one other exercise with you. And this is a Tonglen exercise. So those of you who are familiar with the practice of Tonglen know that Tonglen is a method of meditation in which you sit and are attentive to your breath, but as you breathe out, you think, I give goodness to the world. And as you breathe in, you think, I remove suffering from the world. Now, because this is your imagination, you're not really removing the suffering from the world, because as we know, it's a little bit difficult to do that as an unenlightened being. So, but what we have to do is train our attitude so that we would want to, if it should ever become available to us, the power to truly remove suffering from others, we'll take that opportunity. But there's also no way to say that it doesn't benefit others, because everything we do to make our mind more positive subtly changes the entire world. It actually does. It actually subtly changes. If for no other reason than our negativity is being dialed down a little bit. So, this exercise was written by a Lama, a Western Lama you met before. He was here a few years ago, Lama Sultram Yeshe. And he offers a program around the country called Healing from Trauma. He works with a psychotherapist, and the two of them teach methods for working with and healing trauma. And he says, sometimes if people experience something traumatic, it's as though they're in a jail. They're like a prisoner of their past. The past becomes present, and so forth. And yet, the pain of the past sometimes becomes familiar and in some ways slightly comfortable. And it's a little hard to imagine being away from it. But he said, sometimes we come up with negative self-statements like, I'm not a good person, or I'm a bad person, or things like this. And he says, so what we have to do is we have to find a way to heal that thought. I'm not good enough, or I'm a bad person. And so he says there's a Tibetan saying, if you have a warm place in your heart for yourself, you will be comfortable wherever you go. I love that saying. If you have a warm place in your heart for yourself, you will be comfortable wherever you go. And through Tonglen, we can learn to nurture that warm place. And this is, to me, how we encourage ourselves to do what is right, by developing that warmth for ourselves. And so he says I'm going to lead you in a short practice of Tonglen. And so he says, this is how you can learn a little bit of love for yourself. He said, sit comfortably in meditation. So you might try this. Sit comfortably from meditation. He says, close your eyes and visualize yourself in front of you, perhaps 10 minutes into the future you. Visualize yourself in the future, perhaps 10 minutes into the future, sitting in front of you, facing you. When you breathe in, imagine that you are removing suffering and harm and negative attitudes and anger you might have toward yourself, feelings that you might be helpless or powerless, or any negative feeling you have toward yourself. He said, this is compassion, wanting to remove your future suffering. Then when you breathe out, imagine breathing out light, which goes to the you in front and soaks into the future you, as though the future you is sunbathing and soaking up the light. The light carries with it contentment, satisfaction, cheerfulness, joy, delight, well-being, lightheartedness, and forgiveness. You're transferring it from the present you to the future you. This is love. So we're going to do this for about a minute or two, thinking of ourselves just a couple minutes into the future in front of us, breathing in and removing our suffering and perhaps self-judgment, and then breathing out to us a sense of satisfaction and acceptance. So I'll time it with my little bell. So this little exercise is a way of nurturing the goodness that's within us. Because we have all of this basic goodness, and we make contact with it, and we accept it, and we see it, and we develop it, and we nurture it through this exercise. Because, of course, the outcome of this exercise is that now we are the person that we visualized a few minutes into the future. The person who has received our acceptance, the person who has received our love and our compassion. This is a wonderful little exercise, and I'll see if there's a way to put it online so that you can read about it and do it at home. What Lama Soltram Yeshe says is in his description, he says, compassion for yourself is necessary for spiritual growth and to escape the jail of our negative self-judgment. He said the negativity that you breathe in and remove from yourself can contain any thoughts that you hold on to that cause you to suffer. And the goodness that you give yourself is the wish for you and others to be happy. He says it's preparing that warm place in your heart. He says when you prepare that warm place in your heart, he says you remember that you are a person too. You're a person too, and you're worthy of love. Love that you receive without having to earn it. He said, when a person has experienced trauma, it can be difficult to know and experience love that is free from negative emotions. And he said, but with this practice, fondness, tenderness, warmth, and so on are associated with the love in this practice. The light you are breathing out to yourself can carry anything that makes you truly happy. And so he said, this is intended to be done regularly for, he said, 5 to 10 minutes every day. It is fine if you want to do it for less, but if you want to do it more, it's fine to extend the time. He says, during any one session, you can concentrate on a few things for the inhalation and a few things for the exhalation. Use whatever is most needed at the time. One day, it might be that you breathe in and remove your anger, and you breathe out forgiveness to yourself. Another would be you breathe in and remove your fear and anxiety, and you breathe out and give yourself safety and security and fearlessness. And this way, the lock, he says, on the jail of self-criticism opens. You begin to discover the advice and that this prison guard is giving you in your mind is not necessarily going to help you, and that you can open the door to a more spacious world. So, at any rate, just wanted to share those bits of exercise with you. The idea of nurturing the warm heart toward yourself, to me, is one of the best ways to ensure that we are able to make those changes. That we're able to make those changes because if we are able to resist doing the negative things that are habitually in our kit of habitual things, and if we can then extend and develop warmth for ourselves, this will help us choose the right things to do. So I guess that concludes the talk, the series of talks, making resolutions, avoiding the negative, and nurturing the positive. And hopefully these will be things that will help us. I often tell people that they should look at their Buddha nature as though it were their most precious child. Your Buddha nature is like your own most precious child. And you would not harm your most precious child. You would take care of and nurture your most precious child. And so if you think of your Buddha nature as being like a child that you nurture and care for and develop, It's a really good way to learn how to take care of yourself in a positive way. So I talked a lot, sorry. But we have about 15 minutes. And so in the last 15 minutes, if anybody has questions or curiosities or things they'd like to say, the question microphone is up on this side of the room. So if anybody has curiosity, question, or whatever, we do have a customer. And you can get in line if you wish. Yeah, that might need, there we go, adjustment.
Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah. Got a coughing fit there. Yes, hi.
Good morning. About a year and a half ago or so, I started getting all these teachings about daily meditation.
About what?
Daily meditation.
Daily meditation, okay. Mm-hmm.
From visiting teachers, webcasts, mm-hmm. teachers right here in this room.
Sure.
About doing a daily meditation.
Sure.
And finally, I said, okay, I got it.
Yeah.
I'm going to start doing it. And just as an aside, I would say that the result, the benefit is remarkable.
Cool.
But as soon as I started, I stopped hearing that message.
Uh-huh. Right.
It was like I was sort of attracting it or something until I actually accepted it. Well,
right.
The point of me bringing that up is that the message that I've been hearing very recently is change. So I must be attracting that. So mm-hmm. thank you very much for being part of that teaching for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you what, one of my teachers once said, the teacher has the easy job. They just talk. But the student has the tougher job because the student has to then apply that. So it's like, thanks for doing the work. Yeah. I appreciate that because that's really where, that's how change happens. You know, what's interesting is I tell people that part of the benefit of having a daily habit of meditation is that we learn how to be mindful. We become more mindful as we notice what's on our mind and let go and come back and all of that. We get more mindful, and then we can put that mindfulness that we've developed, like a skill, the mindfulness we develop, knowing what's on our mind and knowing how to change it, we put it in the service of something. That mindfulness, Kempo Rinpoche says it's like sharpening a knife, but then never cutting anything with it. You know, he says, shamatha is not done just for its own sake. It's done so that we can then use that incisiveness, that mindfulness to notice and put ourselves back on the path when we fall off. So it's still back in there. Yeah, so thank you. Yeah. 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 Morning. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I have a question on
sure.
this whole existence, so
sure.
What's the whole grand scheme or point of us having to go through these hurdles of mind? Like, what's the point of this whole scheme?
Mm-hmm.
And what is the great attainment from getting past these hurdles? What is
getting
that,
past what?
All these mental hurdles.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What, mm-hmm. what is the mm-hmm. big grand benefit
yeah.
of accomplishing that?
Mm-hmm.
And what
right.
hit all this here in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why are we in this? Like, it doesn't
right.
make any sense to me.
No, I completely understand. I'm going to give you a small parable that the Buddha taught on this topic, and then I'll talk a little bit. I mean, the basic answer is freedom. That's really that's the goal of the whole thing is freedom.
I know.
Yeah.
But what put us in bondage in the first place?
Yeah, and that's where the Buddha's parable comes into play. I'll tell the parable, and then I'll explain the way my teacher answers this question, which I think is kind of brilliant. It has to do with the coexistence of ignorance and wisdom side by side, but I'll get to that in a minute, okay? So first of all, somebody asked the Buddha, well, Buddha, you're so smart, how did this world come into being? Who created it? And the joke answer is that he said, none of your business. That's a joke. But then he said, if I am shot with an arrow, my first thought is not going to be, I wonder, who was the woman, who was the mother of the person who shot me? I'm not going to be trying to figure out who she was. He says, I'm going to be pulling out that arrow and ending suffering. And he said, my teaching, so that's the point of the parable is that he said, my teaching is about ending suffering. And whether we call it ending suffering and its causes, or we talk about bringing freedom and its causes, either way, that's what happens. Now, how did we get confused in the first place? How is it that we don't know who we are? How is it that we don't know our Buddha nature? That's your other question, right?
Yes.
Okay. Here's how, I'm going to tell you how my teacher explained it. It may or may not work, but this is what he said. He said, our mind that we have right now was never created by anyone. He said, this is the teaching of the Buddha. There wasn't someone who created our mind in the past. He says, our mind has always existed from the no beginning of time and always will exist to the no ending of time. And that it passes through a series of lifetimes based on the habits that it accrues. So we accrued the habit to be born as human beings in this world. So that's the karma that brought us to this place. Now, why is it that some people know they have Buddha nature and other people don't? And he said, it's because from beginningless time until now, our mind has had two modes of being. The mode of ignorance and the mode of wisdom. He said, these have sat side by side since beginningless time. Wisdom and Buddha nature is there, but he said, the mere sheen of ignorance. It's like the oil slick on a puddle of water. You know how that sheen of oil on top of water? He said, our ignorance of our Buddha nature, our fact that we don't even know it's there, that ignorance is what's kept us in bondage for all these lifetimes after lifetimes after lifetimes. And he said, the purpose of all Buddhist practice is to dispel that ignorance. And he said, if we can dispel that ignorance, and people can actually experience their mind as it really is, then, he said, they can gain freedom. He says, it's as though you sat in front of a magician who made something disappear, and then you figured out how he did it. And then you're not fooled by that trick anymore. And so, to me, what I get from that story is that freedom is our goal. And we get freedom through understanding both the intellectual idea of what the mind is, but also the meditative experience of what the mind is. Because until we sit in meditation and watch that thought disappear, we may not believe that thoughts are not solid. Somebody might say, oh, well, your thoughts are impermanent. They're not solid. But we may not believe that until we actually sit and we watch that thought disappear. And we know that it's not solid. So if it's not solid, that means we don't necessarily have to live and die by that thought. You see what I'm saying? And so there's a freedom there to be able to choose that which brings happiness for ourselves and others, and not those things that cause suffering for ourselves and others. Was that, I don't know if that, did I say that right? Did that work?
Somewhat.
Somewhat. Okay. What's missing?
I have another question. Hmm? What's been on my mind a lot for a couple months is mortality.
Mm-hmm, sure.
How
sure.
My eventual decomposition will happen. What really is the point of this too? Like, why are we so afraid of decomposing and dying? Mm-hmm. What is that condition?
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
Why is it so fearful to us if we are just mind?
Right, you know? Exactly. And I think, again, this comes back to the ignorance faction, the factor of ignorance, because people don't know. They're impermanent. I don't understand why they don't get that, but a lot of people don't get that they're impermanent. I actually met a person who was an actor, and they had a beautiful appearance, and all they could think about, they had like pictures of themselves on the wall of their own home, showing how beautiful they were in the past. And they were like terrified of getting old and looking, like an old person. So I think what happens is that people become fixated. They become fixated on me, I. They become so fixated on the me or the I, which is all made of these thoughts which are impermanent, and that really blew my mind when I figured that part out. But I think they become so fixated that they make believe, they make themselves believe that nothing should ever change. And so then, that's why they're afraid. They look in the mirror and they say, wait a minute, I said nothing was supposed to ever change. And then that freaks them out. Because they get gray hair. They freak out. And I think it's because we live in an amazing world where lots of amazing things can happen. People can cheat death and things like that. They have doctors and, you know, treatments and everything, and life can be extended and extended and extended. And I think what happens is that it extends our denial. It extends our denial of what's really happening. So I think that's why. But we have to have compassion for that. It's like they don't get it, so we have to have compassion for why they don't get it. But we ourselves have to work on being understanding impermanence ourselves. Does that make sense?
That makes sense.
Awesome. Okay, yeah, okay. Anybody else have a question? First of all, let me see. Anybody else have a question? You have a comment? Okay, so then a question and then comment. Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, we
will. This will be the last question, and then you get me make your comment. Yeah.
No.
Hey, no problem. This is what I do, you know.
Now, it was the question of mind, mortality. Now, my last question is, if all is mind and that is all that exists, when you eventually decompose, then what is the nature of the other side? Is that also a trap to get through?
What's really interesting is that it goes back to the original description of mind. And let me add one more aspect to the description of what mind is. Okay, I got this from my teacher, and this is what he told me. He said the mind is not a material thing. Your mind is not a material thing. It's not made of atoms or molecules. It's really, in some ways, nothing. And yet, it can't be nothing because it knows things. Your mind knows and experiences. We're experiencing this room right now. The body's conveying the information, but the mind is what's experiencing it, right? The mind is where the memory is. Yeah, the brain helps out, but, I mean, even a corpse has a brain, but it doesn't have a mind. I'm just saying. So, the mind is not a material thing. And yet, because it knows and it experiences, it's not nothing. Okay, so, this is the continuity of the mind. They call it empty and yet luminous. They use descriptive words like in literature. It's empty of solidity, but it's not nothing. It knows and experiences, and they call that mind's luminosity or mind's clarity. Or mind's radiance. So, this radiance and clarity have always been together from beginningless time until now. But through our karmic accumulation, we have this particular body in this particular lifetime. When we pass away, and when we die in this life, the teachings of the Buddha, this is what the Buddha said, so, you know, we can take it or leave it, but this is what the Buddha said. Buddha said that when we die, the mind and the body, which have been together for all those years, come apart. And the mind goes on and continues to experience. We know this is so because some people who have died and come back to life have explained that they continue to experience. They experience places and people and situations. So we know that it goes on. But how it goes on, we're probably going to have to find out. But the Buddha said that after one dies, one does continue to experience based on the karma that one has accumulated during the most recent previous lifetime. And also all the other karma that goes behind. It's like the next most powerful karma is what pushes us. But so they do say that there is experience after death. And in fact, they talk about the Tibetans. The Tibetan Buddhists talk about the bardo, this period between death and rebirth, and that it describes lots of experiences that happen as the mind experiences its radiance in various ways. Right now, we're experiencing our radiance like this, as this room, this situation, these people, these thoughts. But the radiance will continue forever, never stops. I sat with a very wise young teacher. He had to be like, well, I don't know, 28, 29 years old. And he's like, I said, oh, what's this whole Buddhist concept of radiance and awareness? What's that? And he says, oh, he said, that's easy. He says, do you see this? And he waved his hand in front of my face. I said, yeah. And he said, do you hear this? I said, uh-huh. He said, that's awareness. He said, you're aware of what you see, you're aware of what you hear, and you can actually be aware of that awareness. He said, that you can be aware of that awareness, and it never stops. He said, whether you're in a stupor, whether you're awake, whether you're asleep, it's continuous. Never ends. So that's pretty cool. Anyway, so.
So basically, the whole process is to become aware of the passing over. Is that what this?
Yes, it, to practice awareness at the time of death, absolutely, and also to, but the other part of it is to build. Yeah, she'll come up. The other part of it is to build this compassion, because as we build compassion, we are of more benefit to others. If it's all about me, 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 we may not. I mean, we may learn something and may get some measure of freedom, but it won't be total freedom because we're still self-absorbed. So that's why we have to slowly and gradually open to other beings and see their pain and try to help their suffering. So that's the point.
That makes sense.
Okay, thanks a lot. Now, thanks for those questions. Those are excellent, excellent questions. Okay, this will be the last comment today. Hey, Johanna.
Hi.
Hey.
While you're talking, my mind went
okay.
Other way. And I wanted.
I have that effect on people.
Well,
I'm joking.
It was something that came up when he was talking.
Sure.
And what I know that none of us know what it is like to be born.
Right.
We have no concept.
Right.
We have no information.
Sure.
So we come into this world,
mm-hmm.
and then we experience
mm-hmm.
what people give to us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I believe we grow.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's hard for us to differentiate between, oh, this person mm-hmm. told me this, but this person told me this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
what is the truth?
Right.
And again, like you said, it's an awareness.
Right.
And as we get older, mm-hmm. we have had more and more experiences
mm-hmm.
and have seen people who have died violent deaths.
Mm-hmm.
We have seen some that actually died in their sleep.
Sure.
So we have those images.
Mm-hmm.
And with those images, people are holding on to that
mm-hmm.
because they fear
mm-hmm.
that is going to be something that I'm going to experience, something
sure.
violent.
Sure. Sure, sure.
And we wish that we could just simply die in our sleep,
mm-hmm.
and then we could travel on
mm-hmm.
to our mm-hmm. Separation of mind mm-hmm. and body.
Sure.
I am grateful mm-hmm. for those schools
mm-hmm.
that are teaching our young children
mm-hmm.
about meditation.
Right.
And I hope that yeah. the schools continue
mm-hmm.
that process, because mm-hmm. if it isn't practiced, like you said, on a daily basis,
mm-hmm.
they may end up
mm-hmm.
Wandering.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, I appreciate
that's my comment.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that. I think it is true. I think it's true that we've kind of wandered around aimlessly for a very long time. One of the lamas once said, yeah, it's really kind of funny. We've all, like, died so many times we don't even know, you know, how many. We lost count. And we've been born so many times we just lost count. But we don't remember any of it. And so I think this, what's really interesting is this is also true of things in this life, because many people experience difficulties in this life, but they sort of forget about them. They recede into the background. And so even in this life, we can see that things that happen to us recede into our memory, and sometimes they won't disappear entirely, but their effect will be blunted or changed over the years. And so how much more so things that change over a lifetime? But I do think you're right that the more we practice awareness, the more we practice meditation and awareness, the more we can be actually present in our lives and to sort of, I guess you could say, kind of get with the program of our lives and begin to help other people who are suffering and who don't know what to do. So I think that's very, very beneficial. A long time ago, I got interviewed by a researcher from, I believe it was Rutgers University. And the person was talking about neighborhood churches and faith traditions and how they can help people in their neighborhoods. But they also asked a lot of philosophical questions, like what is one of the biggest problems facing society today? And this question was asked of me about 15 years ago. So this is before all the things that are happening now. And I said, I think that a lot of people feel that their lives have no purpose and there's no point. That people don't see a purpose to their life or a meaning to their life, and that this is what leads to all of the problems that we experience with addiction and self-destruction and disliking oneself and so forth, is because we don't feel that we have meaning or purpose. And so then their interviewer said, well, then how can you give meaning and purpose to people? And I said, by showing them the suffering of the world and how other people suffer, not themselves, but how others suffer, and then at the same time showing them what impact they can have on that suffering. Not just showing them suffering, but showing them how they personally can have an impact. And I remember being a kid in school. When I was in grade school, we went to another school and participated as young teenagers in an after-school program for smaller children, where we would read to them and help them with their homework. That was fantastic. It changed my life because I realized that other people had lives too, and some of them were not as fortunate as mine, and that I could actually have an impact on somebody else's life by doing something with them. I wasn't that smart, but I could help that child with their homework. How cool is that? I knew that much more than that young child, and I could help with what I had. And knowing that I can have an impact on helping somebody else, it was life-changing for me. And so I said, maybe that's what we should do with everybody. You know, show them all how they can help themselves and others. So anyway, I see I've run out over time a little bit, but thank you for that. And so let's, rather than reciting a prayer at the end here, we'll mentally dedicate the goodness of this session. We dedicate the goodness of this session and all the goodness we've ever accumulated to the freedom and liberation of all beings, their liberation and freedom from a bondage of all kinds, outer and inner, and their recognition of their Buddha nature, their attainment of awakening, and then their emanation to all worlds to benefit sentient beings endlessly. We mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Hey, thank you.